It's Friday, July 10th. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is the Pen Pod, a limited-run podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, the major tech companies decide not to share data with Hong Kong authorities, at least temporarily. Will there be a showdown with China's government? Will the U.S. ban TikTok? And how did a letter in Harper's Magazine lead to a heated debate over privilege and free speech? We put those questions to our CEO, Suzanne Nossel, in our weekly Tough Questions segment. I'm Stephen Fee. That's all ahead on the Pen Pod. It's Friday, which means it's time for Tough Questions, our weekly segment where we put tricky questions about free speech and free expression to our CEO, Suzanne Nossel. And she joins me now. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Stephen.
So, Suzanne, let's start with Hong Kong. This week, the big U.S. tech players, including Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Zoom, Twitter, they all said they would stop processing requests from Hong Kong authorities to use their data, at least temporarily. TikTok has pulled its app from the region altogether. Is this a sign that the companies are going to take a harder line on how they interact with law enforcement or known human rights violators? Or do you think this is just a temporary PR move?
Yeah, look, I think it's at least conditionally a positive move in that they recognize that the transformation in Hong Kong with this national security law and putting Hong Kong much more squarely underneath Beijing's thumb and a edict this week that tech companies that do not comply will have their employees be vulnerable to imprisonment for not turning over data, that this necessitates a pretty wholesale review of how they're approaching their presence in the Hong Kong market. And I think that's a positive step that they have taken that on board and that they're not simply trying to pretend this is business as usual. You know, none of these companies, except for TikTok, operate inside China. And, you know, many of them have had to and fro tussles, you know, Google going back and forth with the Chinese government, trying to figure out whether there were terms under which they could stay in the market and really failing to kind of come to a situation they were comfortable with. You know, there was a very high profile case of Yahoo years ago turning over data at the demand of the Beijing government, and then the individual Yahoo user, you know, being subject to imprisonment based on evidence that the tech company, that Yahoo, the platform, had provided. And so they don't want to be in that position of essentially incriminating their users. It's a PR disaster. You know, it runs counter to all the values that they profess to stand for. They're under a lot of pressure, as it is with the boycott of Facebook, you know, now going into its second month. So this is, you know, for now, sort of a temporary pause. And I think they're evaluating, you know, what this is going to entail going forward and whether will the Beijing government blink? Will they offer some more flexibility so that the platforms can stay in Hong Kong? You know, Hong Kong changes radically if you cut off all of global social media. This is, you know, it's an international hub. It's a very cosmopolitan population. These platforms have huge user bases in Hong Kong who are very active. You know, you've seen a lot of those people kind of going dark or at least, you know, sanitizing their posts, in some cases going through and deleting past Twitter posts and Facebook posts to ensure that, you know, try to shield themselves from, you know, this government scrutiny that they're now worried about under the new law. And I think it's going to end up being something of a standoff between the companies and Beijing. You know, is Beijing willing to, you know, offer a little bit of wiggle room so that they can continue to operate under terms that, you know, are acceptable or not going to provoke mass outcry and put them in the position of, you know, landing their users in jail or not? And are those companies going to have to withdraw from Hong Kong entirely, which would really accelerate the kind of freezing out of Hong Kong from the rest of the world?
Yeah. It seems like there's a gauntlet being thrown down. Well, speaking of TikTok, it made some news in the U.S. this week. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo threatened to ban the app in the United States. You know, at first glance, you know, it seems like a swipe at free expression, especially because the president has increasingly become a target of derision on the TikTok platform. At the same time, we've seen the U.S. government make moves to lock out Chinese telecom companies, Huawei being one major example, when they think it poses a national security threat. Where do you come down?
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, TikTok is fascinating. It's a Chinese company. It's a very successful private company that, you know, is getting ready for an IPO, is very highly valued, has really exploded in global usage. You know, this concern that because it's a Chinese company, ultimately, if Beijing were to demand all the user data that TikTok has collected, that they'd be able to get it, you know, no, with no obstacle, you know, has been a concern for a long time. It's frankly a concern that I have. You know, don't ask my daughter about this, but she's not allowed to have TikTok for that reason. I just sort of feel like I don't want her registered right now with the Chinese government. I'm not ready for that yet. And so I think there are some legitimate underlying concerns here. You know, this particular step of threatening to kick TikTok out. Actually, India has done that. And India had a huge installed user base for TikTok and has just banned the company from the entire country. And so it's not an unprecedented step. I think they did it, you know, in the midst of a worsening bilateral relationship between Delhi and Beijing. And so I think Pompeo is looking at that. You know, it's interesting because at the same time, TikTok, which, you know, always was just this kind of fun-loving platform for dance videos and stuff, is becoming a lot more political over the last few months, a lot more protest videos, you know, this whole movement that arose on TikTok where you had people signing up for Trump's rally in Tulsa with no intention of actually attending, but the goal of taking up tickets and convincing the organizers that they were in for, you know, some huge gathering when the actual numbers disappointed drastically. And that was sort of touted and celebrated as a moment of triumph for Trump's critics, kind of effectuated via TikTok. I think it was a teacher who sparked the whole thing by making the initial call. So TikTok is kind of playing this, you know, more potent political role. The company is also considering kind of redomiciling its headquarters outside of China. They've hired an American CEO, you know, and yet their DNA and ownership is fundamentally Chinese. And they're really kind of coming into some of the difficult dilemmas that gives rise to in terms of Beijing's ultimate control over the company, kind of no matter probably what the executives say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to just finally end on a letter that made a lot of waves this week in Harper's Magazine. It was signed by over 150 celebrities, writers, thinkers, and artists, and it was really about threats to free expression. However, critics immediately took aim, saying it showed that the writers had thin skins or that they were privileged and talking about a cancel culture that didn't affect them or even were gasps of a loss of relevance of the signatories. Do you think the critics missed the point?
You know, I do think it's very legitimate to put forward a call for free expression and an alert to some of the perils of the kind of punitive caste that characterizes what some people call cancel culture. You know, I also think it's true that this is a historic moment of reckoning on issues of inequality and racism and anti-Black violence. And, you know, that all these things are kind of true at the same time. And it's one of the, what I've been thinking over the last few weeks is, or days rather, is, you know, this is why I had to have 20 principles in my book, because it's kind of like you have to say all 20 things. Like if you just say sort of one or two things, like don't punish speech, you know, without saying that you recognize the harms of speech, that you are committed to fighting against hateful speech and hate crimes, you know, that you're determined to be conscientious in the use of language, that you recognize there's a duty of care that people who have positions of authority and important platforms hold, that if you sort of leave out any one of those things, even though the other things may be perfectly valid, there's sort of an assumption that, you know, you're missing part of the picture, or your message is skewed, or you're leaving out, you know, these questions of power relations. So I think that's what makes talking about free speech in the present moment so complicated. And, you know, it's honestly one of the reasons why I have kind of tried to lay this out, because I sort of do think you have to say all these things. They're all really important. It's a lot to take on board, you know, at any one time. But ultimately, if we're going to be, you know, both a more equitable, inclusive, and just society, and a society that sustains robust protections for free speech, you know, we've got to learn to walk and chew gum at the same time, and to sort of reflect all these values in how we put ourselves forward. And I think, you know, that is a bit of what the letter was faulted with, was that even though there was a strong statement of support for the protest movement, I think that it maybe moved a bit too quickly onto, you know, this question of punishments for speech and didn't talk enough about the enablers and obstacles to free speech, you know, who really enjoys free speech in this society and other important aspects of the picture. I mean, one of the other sort of subplots that became really interesting is the question of who is on the letter and criticism right. of signatories, not because of the content of the letter, but because they sort of allowed themselves to be seen alongside certain other people. It was almost like, we canceled that other person, so now we're going to cancel you for being on a letter, you know, alongside the canceled person. And, you know, that's sort of a new level in a sense. I mean, I think there is something powerful about the fact that the letter attracted what you think of as strange bedfellows and people who are on the opposite sides of issues, but who might have a kernel that they could agree on. And that, you know, that's actually sort of a hopeful thing. Even if you may revile, you know, everything else that person stands for, maybe there's a tiny little stretch of common ground. And, you know, those pieces of common ground in such a polarized society, you know, I think stand to be potentially important. And so, you know, I think that idea that, you know, you're pillorying people for allowing themselves to be on a list with certain other people, you know, that to me sort of goes too far, and it should be evaluated more on the basis of the content of the letter that these individuals were signing.
Yeah, rather than the co-signatories. And this is something I should add. I mean, this is, you know, we do sign on letters all the time. Nonprofits do this, NGOs do this. And oftentimes it's exactly that. It's showing the strange bedfellows that give us more credence in the message.
Well, that's true. And we've never, to be honest, you know, I don't think we've been asked, or nor have we shown the entire list of signatories, or, you know, if we've shown it at all, it's sort of to attract other people. We've never sort of had the notion that you'd want to approve not just the letter itself, but also the list of names of all the other signatories. But I'm sure we will get that request henceforward.
Absolutely. Well, Suzanne Nossel is CEO of PenAmerica. As she mentioned, her book, Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All, comes out in just a few weeks. You can actually pre-order now at pen.org/dare to speak. There's also a full lineup of virtual events that Suzanne will be doing starting this summer and moving into the fall. Thanks so much, as always, Suzanne.
Thank you. Take care.
Before we go, a quick programming note. Subscribers may have gotten an early listen to a Natasha Trethewey interview yesterday. We accidentally released that a bit before we'd been scheduled to do so. But don't worry, we'll have the full episode premiering later this month. And that's our episode for Friday, July 10th. Join us next week for the Pen Pod. You can listen to all our episodes at pen.org. Follow us at PenAmerica on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Sign up on our website for our daily Dare newsletter. That's where we track major stories about literature, free expression, and the news of the world. I'm Stephen Fee for PenAmerica. This is the Pen Pod. See you Monday.